is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Jonathan Schanzer, Senior Vice President Research at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, to help me interpret the headlines that are competing and clashing out of the Middle East. We begin with Hezbollah, the party of God, the gangsters who live in Beirut, at war with Israel and, as far as I can tell, every other region around them. But the death of Nasrallah has left a hole in the wiring diagram of a military organization filled by a man named Naim Qassam, Secretary General, just named by Iran. That tells the story. Jonathan, you tell me this is a very well-known man, Naim Qassam. From his photograph that they're giving us, he looks like a well-meaning old man with a beard that he's much too vain about and making a pitch to somebody who's unseen in the room. Who is he? What do we need to know about him? Good evening.
Good evening, John. Yeah, Naim Qassam is, you can actually buy his book on Amazon. It's called Inside Hezbollah. And he has written his story about how he has viewed the evolution of Hezbollah over the years since the organization was formed in the 1980s. He was, I think, perhaps best known for having built Hezbollah's propaganda organ, also known as Al-Manar, which means the beacon. And this is the television station that Hezbollah uses to put out its propaganda to the Lebanese people and for many others. This is a really kind of a shocking move when you consider it, because, you know, this guy has no military background to speak of. This man is, I think, obviously already marked for death by the Israelis. He's one of the top figures that was in the org chart that is still surviving to date. So I think he's already on the endangered species list, but this is not the man that I would have expected. There's a reason why Hashim Safieddine, for example, was chosen before him after the death of Hassan Nasrallah. This is a second or third choice at this point, but there aren't too many people left inside that org chart for Hezbollah to choose from, or as you put it, for the Iranians to choose from, perhaps more pointedly.
The protocol, Nasrallah would make speeches every Friday or Saturday, and that would be the marching orders for the whole of the Hezbollah. Is this a public speaker? He does not look like we're looking at Huey Long here. He looks like a character you would be in the back room making deals.
Look, I think he's fluent in Hezbollah, you know, if we're to put it that way. I think he knows how to speak. He's watched enough of Hassan Nasrallah's speeches over the years, and I think he certainly knows how to frame the propaganda of Hezbollah. That is exactly what he is. He's a Hezbollah propagandist. The question really is about his delivery. Will he inspire Hezbollah? Because Hezbollah is in complete disarray right now. It's not just that Nasrallah and Safieddine have been killed, but also the Radwan forces, the highly trained ground forces of Hezbollah, they have been eviscerated. A lot of the other top leaders have been also killed. The group's infrastructure in southern Lebanon, the Israelis have actually just announced today that they are done with the vast majority of the ground operations that were needed in order to secure their goals for a possible ceasefire. So having this guy in the helm, having Naim Qassam there, it'll be interesting because, you know, I think we're all wondering right now whether he is, or anybody is, in the position they'll be able to continue to rally the troops to continue to wage this war that Hezbollah has been fighting against Israel since October 8th of 2023.
The report from the region right now is 30 rockets fired from Lebanon at Upper Galilee. In other words, business as usual. To what end? What is Hezbollah saying these rockets are meant to convey?
Well, it's interesting, John, because, you know, I've had some fascinating conversations with the Israelis who are allowed to talk in the aftermath of the strikes in Iran and what we've seen in Lebanon. What I think is not fully understood right now is that, you know, look, these 200 rockets per day, give or take, today we've seen a bit fewer. You know, they look foreboding. It looks like it's disastrous for Israel. Of course, some are making direct strikes. We've seen people get injured. We've seen people get killed. But compare this to what the assessments were of Hezbollah's capabilities leading into this war. And it's just far weaker than anything you can imagine. The assessment early on was that Hezbollah would be able to fire 3,000 rockets into Israeli airspace, that they would be able to do immense damage, to be able to overwhelm Israel's defense systems, that they would blacken Israeli skies, that you would see thousands of Israelis dead, you would see skyscrapers toppling. None of those things have happened. And so what we make of these rockets is that Hezbollah's unable to mount the kind of offensive that we all thought it capable of before Israel set off those exploding pagers and walkie-talkies and took out the top leaders and invaded southern Lebanon. Now, I want to warn that Hezbollah still has some of those long-range capabilities. They still have some of those precision-guided munitions. We've not seen them bring them out. The question is why? And this is, I think, the question that nobody knows how to answer yet. And I think a lot of it really has to do with whether or not there is sufficient leadership and even a strategy to sustain Hezbollah's war effort beyond merely the war of attrition that we've been watching for more than a year.
The new Iranian president, Masoud Pezeshkian, quoted about Naeem Qassam's ascendance. He says he will strengthen the will of the resistance. He goes on to say the cessation of aggression by the illegal Zionist regime and the establishment of peace, tranquility, and security in Gaza, Lebanon, and the entire region. This man, Pezeshkian, I've been reading about how he has an open hand towards Europe, how he wants to have a dialogue. Who is he? I mean, why does he make these foolish statements about something he knows very little about and then at the same time presents himself as a peacemaker?
Look, the thing about Masoud Pezeshkian is, we continue to hear that he has been a voice of moderation inside the kitchen cabinet of the supreme leader, that he has tried to actually restrain the regime from engaging in an all-out war with Israel, that he's more concerned about building back the economy of Iran and keeping the regime stable. I think that horse has left the barn. When we see what the Iranians did on October 1st and what we see now about Israel's response to the Iranian regime and the damage that they caused to a lot of the war-making infrastructure that have left the Iranian regime rather naked to future Israeli strikes. Pezeshkian, at this point, the only thing that he has left is his bluster. He lost the battle inside that cabinet meeting, if those reports were true in the first place, but I do not see him having a significant impact right now. This is a war that will be decided by the Supreme Leader and by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. I don't believe that this president will have much to say at all, one way or the other.
Let's go to Tehran. After the Israeli strike, there's a quote today from the IDF command that if Iran attacks Israel again, we'll hit places we spared this time, places we spared this time. But there was, in the first 24, 48 hours after the strike, Iran saying, we won't hit back again. The story changes day to day. Is there anything we can hold on to, or is this the way we're just going to deal with? They wake up in the morning and they go left or right, depending on how they feel.
Look, the regime knows right now that it is significantly weakened. The Israelis took out just about every S-300, Russian-made S-300 system. Their skies are, they cannot defend their skies any longer. From what we understand right now, the assessments that we're hearing out of Israel, and even from some folks here in the United States, we are hearing that the regime is extremely vulnerable. For them to carry out a significant airstrike from Iran, sending ballistic missiles into Israel, I think would be disastrous. I think the Israelis would likely take out oil facilities. I think they would probably begin to even target military facilities. You could imagine them striking leadership targets, IRGC, intelligence. I mean, the options are effectively endless because there's very little that the Iranians would be able to do to counter a full-on Israeli strike on assets that were perhaps even more meaningful than what the Israelis struck on Friday evening. So I think the likelihood is low for now that the regime would strike Israel directly. But I think that the likelihood is still rather high that we're going to see the so-called Ring of Fire activated, the various proxies that are able to fire on Israel from Yemen, the Houthis, from Iraq and Syria, these Shiite militias loyal to the regime. Hezbollah to the extent that they're able to muster it. I think the regime is still fighting. It's very likely they'll fight until the bitter end. But there will come a moment if the Israelis continue to press their offensive here. There could come a moment. I think it's very likely we'll see that moment come where quietly this war will peter out.
The puzzle for me, Jonathan, and many others watching this, Iran is the story, not Hezbollah, not Hamas, not the Houthis. They work for Iran. And therefore, how do you make peace with the regime that has used its surrogates to murder Israelis and anybody else in their way? Why do you make peace with such a regime? And I don't mean just Israel. I mean the European Union. Pezeshkian has dialogue with the European Union, for heaven's sakes. He might even be on the phone to Rudy of NATO. I don't know. What do they think is the future if you leave an ungoverned space in the hands of gangsters?
Yeah, I look, you know, the engagement with the regime has been a curious thing that we've been watching, really, John, since 2009 or 10 or 11, right? This mistaken assumption that if somehow we engage the regime, we enrich the regime, we treat it as if it is an equal on the world stage, that perhaps they would turn to the arms of the West, lay down their arms themselves, and begin to play a more constructive role in the region. This was the Obama doctrine, if you will, and it failed. It failed horribly. We know this because they spent a huge amount of the money that the West had tried to throw at the regime in order to get it to back down and to be more pragmatic. We saw them invest this money in Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, and all the various actors that are waging war right now across the Middle East. This is a road that leads to nowhere, but yet it is an orthodoxy. It is a religion at this point that we see embraced by Europe, by the United States, at least one party within the United States. It is a huge mistake, but we continue to see this mistake being made one regime after another, one government after another, you know, one continent after another, for that matter. And it is truly maddening to watch, but we can say with certainty that this is not yet out of the bloodstream of the Biden administration or out of Brussels. And it's a huge mistake.
Headline that Egypt and Qatar are discouraged about negotiations over the hostages that Hamas holds. That story has moved to not the lead story anymore. Where is it, Jonathan? Where are the hostages? What's the opinion of getting them back?
Well, look, the good news when Sinwar was killed was that it was a major setback to Hamas's leadership, and it signaled a major momentum shift in the war. The bad news is that he may have been the only man who knew where all of the 101 hostages remained. And so right now there is some chaos that has been injected into the discussions about possible ceasefire for the release of hostages. So now the question becomes, can the U.S. and Israel and the Egyptians and the Qataris, can they broker some kind of a deal that sees the release of two or three or four hostages in exchange for a handful of days of ceasefire? That's where we have been. And that was what was floated to unnamed members of Hamas. Reading the Israeli press, they continue to talk about unnamed members of Hamas. No one wants their names to be out there because we all know what happens to Hamas leaders that make their names public. They would be likely rubbed out by the Israelis. So they are keeping this quiet. But according to what we're seeing in the Israeli press, Hamas has dug in its heels. They are refusing to negotiate further with the Israelis. They still do not want to release these hostages. From what it appears, John, they are willing to fight to the bitter end. So the Israelis will continue to deploy its military into Gaza. They will continue to surround and kill and arrest members of Hamas while they try to find the Israeli hostages that are very likely being held below ground in parts of the tunnel matrix that have yet to be mapped by the Israelis or in places where the IDF has yet to look.
Jonathan Schenzer, Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. When we come back, just a thought about the last days of the Biden administration and where it is with regard to this catastrophe. I'm John Batchelor.